Welcome to the Roseville Tuesday Night Group's 55th Anniversary. Taped by DLR Tapes, Sacramento, California. Our phone number is area code 916-344-3577. Today is January 22nd, 2000. Our main speaker will be Burns B. Thank you.
Let's start the 55th Anniversary of the Roseville Tuesday Night Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hey. The oldest continually active group in Northern California. Right here, I have a few announcements we have to read before.
At least there's two of us tall enough. I'm Wayne, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Wayne.
And I have met Floyd Bowers. In 1944, March, he heard this big meeting in Sacramento, decided to go down and see what it's about. He arrived there, walked in, he became the ninth member of that group. So apparently he went to numerous meetings at that time up until about 9 months later, he decided that he knew all about what Alcoholics Anonymous was, and it's time to celebrate. So like so many of us, he decided on Christmas Day that he'd have a drink. Lo and behold, 26 days later, he decided to sober up. So in order to keep this thing going in his life, he more than likely went back. I don't know, I wasn't there, but he went back to Sacramento and got some refresher courses. And in October of 1945, he got his wife, two friends of his, or three friends, and started meeting at his office down on 301 Main Street, and called it the Roseville Tuesday Night Group. And from there, it grew. Apparently, there became about four meetings in the north part of California. I was thinking about it, and there could have been one in Marysville, there could have been one in Grass Valley, and there could have been one in Woodland. I don't know which one it was. But anyway, there was four meetings, and from his meeting, they grew, and they grew, and they grew. And you can see all the people that have grown through the Roseville Tuesday Night Group, and it still holds approximately 16 meetings per week down at 315 Lincoln Street, and we invite anybody that wants to come down there and get some good solid AA. Thank you.
My name's Ann, and I'm an alcoholic. I think I better change my deodorant. Everybody left. And welcome to the new people, the newcomers. I hope you can take this program seriously. We do have a lot of fun. But you know, when I first came in, it took me 4 months before I could even smile. And it took about 2 years before I could start feeling good about me, because it took that long for me to catch on. Now, I'm worried about some of those newcomers I saw out there tonight, because they were smiling. And babies smile when they got gas. You know, when I came here, I was so darn confused. They tell me to hang in there. Then they say, let go. Well, I kept coming back, and now I hang loose. Then they confused me again. They said, don't make any changes during your first year. Don't change your job. Don't sell your house. Don't get into a relationship. Don't get divorced. Don't do any of those things in your first year. But change we must, or drink we will. So just keep coming back and you'll figure it out. I came in through the care unit, and that's where I learned about this alcoholism as being a disease. The alcohol comes in the bottle, and the ism's in me. And I got the ism for now and forever. I, self, 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 me, me, me. There is no smaller package than an alcoholic all wrapped up in himself. And that's our nature. So this is why I have to keep coming back to these meetings. I've done all the things they've told me to. I got a sponsor. I've worked the steps. I've been in service. I still am in service. I get to meetings, but I got to keep coming. And I thought, you know, maybe I don't need all these meetings. And I went to a speaker meeting one time, and there was this old guy. I don't remember which one it was, but he said, yeah, I got 3 years of this program. And I only need one meeting a week. But it takes five to figure out which one it was I needed. And I thought, wow. So I find that when I get to my meetings, that I'm a lot happier and more content. And if I don't get there, I get this stinking thinking. My mind goes away with me. Stinking thinking leads to drinking. And they told me that my head is a bad neighborhood and I shouldn't go in it alone. Well, I know you all come to hear Dr. Byrne here, so I'm going to try to cut this real fast and give you a broad picture of what this is, but it's only in my first few years. I come from a background where I was from a very modest family. I went to 9 years parochial school, and I was a square. I mean, I did no wrong. They said kids should be seen and not heard. And I sat in the corner. I didn't say a word. And I always followed what I was supposed to do all my life. And here I am. Well, I had to tell you this because what it's leading up to is how you understand my feelings about situations. When I came in the program, our kids were teenagers. We had a 15, a 16, and an 18-year-old. Her birthday was in April, and I came in the program in May. And in June, she graduated from high school for a 4.0 grade average. Nice girl going on to college. Well, we were in the program, and thank God for my Bill because he helped me get to meetings. And then about the second month in July, we went up to Auburn so that we could learn about this AA business, all of the different committees and things that it's made up of. So we went up to Auburn all day. We come home that night, and the 18-year-old says, Mom, I'm leaving home. I'm going to get an apartment tomorrow. From where I come from, you know, this we don't do. But I had enough AA that I had serenity. And I said, well, you know, Doreen, I said, it's not a very good idea because it's going to cost money to rent an apartment. It's going to cost money to support yourself that way. Here you're rent-free and you're going to have books and stuff, you know. Well, I talked to her about 5 minutes. I turned around and she wasn't even in the room. She wasn't hearing a word I said. My God, I lost all serenity I'd ever learned. I pounded the sink. I pounded the floor. I said, the hell with sobriety. Here I am sober, and this sort of thing happens. You know, I mean, all these years I've been drinking, and the kids were fine. The minute I get sober, she's leaving home, my baby. Well, my husband and my son couldn't stop me. I took out that front door. It was about 11 o'clock at night by now. I took out that front door, and I got in the car, and this is the only time in my life that I ever thought of getting drunk. I was a maintenance drinker. I always had a good little glow on, you know. This time, I thought, the hell, I'm just going to chug a lug. So we had no liquor in the house, so I got in the car to go down to the liquor store. I was going to buy a bottle and really gobble it. I turned the headlights on, started the car up, and there was her car sitting across the street. I accelerated and smashed the hell out of it. Well, then, that stopped me. I backed up, parked the car again, and I thought, if I get drunk now, they'll think I was drunk when I did this. So, I went in the, locked the car, went in the house, and I went to sleep. The next day, the car was gone. I never asked where it went. The next time I saw it, it was fixed, but I did ask. But you, newcomers, you know, I didn't have to drink. I went. They call that going to Eddie Legs. But I don't recommend it. So with this, I'm going to end because we want to hear Dr. Byrne. And I'm going to end with a serenity prayer, another version of it. And it's, God grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, the courage to change the person I can, and the wisdom to know that that person is me. Thank you for letting me share.
And next, it's my pleasure to welcome our main speaker tonight, and that's Dr. Burns B. from Louisville, Kentucky.
My name is Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic. Can y'all hear this all right? Is anybody back here? I was just thinking when that young man came up a while ago with one day of sobriety, and was thinking about when I went into the treatment center. Well, actually, I had to get on a plane to fly to one, and I was so drunk when I got on the plane that I was begging him for a drink to keep from withdrawing. And they had two of the stewardesses sitting back there with me. They wouldn't give me a drink, but I think they made that trip in record time because they went. And when, it's inconceivable to me that I could have walked up in before a crowd like this with one day of sobriety. And if somebody had said, I want to introduce you to a person that hadn't had a drink in 48 years, I'd have had two thoughts. One was, they're either lying or they're dead. You know? But it's interesting to watch that young man walk up here and think about how well I'd be able to do that or not, and I'm sure I wouldn't. Thank you for inviting me to your birthday party. Well done job. And I commend the people who have been responsible for it, because I've been on the host committee in Louisville before for a number of years. Not now, but I have been in the past. And that's a lot of work. And I really do appreciate it, being asked and what you've done. I've been asked to come here and tell you a story. One of the things that I've learned in AA is that the first thing that an alcoholic gets back is his opinions. And so what you'll hear tonight will be some opinions. Now, we don't have any opinions, but we do draw damn strong conclusions. So I want you to know that the stuff I'm going to talk about is not my opinions. They're just my conclusions. And thank you. That was a delightful talk, and I really appreciate that. Much obliged. I really do. For many of the newcomers in the room, if this isn't your story and you really have decided you want to be here, then keep coming back. Don't leave before the miracle. Come back and you will hear your story. For those of you who do hear your story, I'm grateful. I will guarantee you, usually when I get through talking, it's not because I feel particularly compelled to draw these kind of responses, but there will be some people in this room that will feel that they truly have seen the way A is supposed to work and they know they're home. There will be other people who will say, I wonder who in the hell that was. And then there will be a group of people who will absolutely hate my guts. And that's okay, because that's the joy and delight of AA. I'm always intrigued by this whole wonderful, wonderful mystery of AA, because here I am, a 63-year-old man with 22 years of sobriety, And I really do believe I can come here and tell you my life in 1 hour. Now, that didn't make any sense, does it? What makes even less sense is there are 1,500 of you who will have an opinion about my talk. You'll grade it and you'll decide if it's good or bad. And isn't that neat? That you think you got sense enough to grade this talk and I think I can do it. Isn't that wonderful? But that's exactly what will happen tonight. And that's AA. And let me tell you what I found out about AA. It's a great place to live. It's a lousy place to visit. You know? If this is home for you, you will have the best ride of your life. But if you think you can just pass through, it won't make any sense to you at all. So your day of commitment hopefully is today, if you haven't already made it. Bill has been an excellent host. He took me down to your meeting room. And that was a delightful, delightful trip. As I stood in that room and looked at the tokens of the people who had died and looked around and felt the spirit and the serenity and the tradition in that room, I really did feel the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not the first time I have, and it won't be the last. But it certainly was very prevalent for me when I was in that room. And that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. Yeah, it'll be my story. But I've reached the point in this recovery process that I really have been able to draw some conclusions. And I feel real strongly about the message that we're going to give the newcomer. And I am very grateful for you newcomers who are here for us to teach you, because that's exactly what we'll do. And I'm very grateful for those of us who've been around for a while to continue to learn and be able to take the responsibility of teaching them. Now my challenge is, what is the message you're going to give them? I have a daughter, 39, who's been in AA for 19 years. I have a son, 33, who's been in AA for 15 years. My daughter gave birth to our first grandchild, actually now our only grandchild, who's about 2 years ago. I went out to see them. The child was born in Omaha. Libby and Michael are living there now, and I went out to see them, and I walked into the nursery to look at Lee, and she was laying in a little crib. And my first thought was, my God, this kid's head's straight. And I delivered babies for those of you who don't know, I'm a doctor, so I don't deliver babies just down at the Greyhound bus station. I really do have the right to deliver babies. So I thought I'd clear that up. And said, my God, he delivers babies. What the hell else does he do? Deliver pizzas? You know, hell, I don't know. But all the babies I delivered, their heads came out sideways. Now, they all straightened out, and I was real grateful for that. So were their parents. So were they. But this kid was laying there, and I thought, her head's straight. Well, that's really neat, you know. Now, when you stand there looking at your grandchild, you have a lot of responses. And most people, the earth people, I'm sure they stand and they look at their grandchild, and they think of Harvard or Yale or USC or Southern Cal or University of Kentucky or Tennessee. I'm sitting there looking at this kid, and I'm thinking of Hazelden, Betty Ford, and What's Your Home Group? I am a doctor, and I've practiced addiction medicine. I did family medicine for 25 years, and I've practiced addiction medicine for the last 12. And I can tell you that I really do know what I'm talking about what we know today about the wonderful thing that Silkworth said. We said we have a physical allergy and a mental obsession. And I can literally put formulas on that wall over there that will tell you what Silkworth was talking about. He did not have the terms at that time, but he was a great observer and recorder. And I can tell you that those formulas will tell us what we know. And I can also tell you that my granddaughter, in this society, has a 97% chance of being an alcoholic. And what I am really concerned about, and hell, I've been trying to get Libby to feed her alcohol in her cereal. Hell, get her started to take her to treatment center next week. Might as well get this shit over with and bring her on to a treatment center. But what I'm really concerned about is the message you're going to give her, because in all probability, I will not be here. And maybe she'll be here. What is the message you'll give her? It seems even more important to me today than it ever has. The other thing that has made me acutely aware of what is the message we're going to give the newcomer, in addition to my own journey, which I'll share with you, and you'll see why it's of major importance to me. and how it developed in my life. But I do two big book studies. I go to a minimum of four meetings a week, and two of those are big book studies. I've been doing those for about the last 10 years. And one of those is on a Wednesday night, and I quit counting at about 25 or 30 because it just was no longer a mystery. The number of people who have gone through that big book study who drank with more than 25 years of sobriety. I've made a 12-step call on a man who got drunk after 42 years. I can't count the number of people I've made 12-step calls with more than 30 years. And each time when I've done that, interestingly enough, they didn't take a drink for that period of time, but I've been fascinated by the message that they got or heard in AA. Virtually none of them ever read the big book, and virtually none of them had ever done the steps. They went to meetings and meetings and meetings and meetings. And in each instance, it was not complacency. It was some challenge that taxed them to the point that they could not conceive of bearing the pain of going through whatever the event was. So I have a real sense of what is the message that we're delivering to the newcomer and to each other. And that's where I focus on the talk that I give today. This is the talk you asked me to come and give. I hope it means as much to you as the chance to get to tell it means to me. I grew up in a little town in western Kentucky named Mayfield. It's a town of 12,000 people. I grew up in a home where there was no alcohol and there were no drugs. My grandfather died drinking lye water in the Mayfield City Jail. He was the town drunk. He died 4 months after AA started. My mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. She was what's known as an adult child of an alcoholic today. Now, if you have a problem with that concept, then go read the big book. Read the family afterward, because basically what it says is if you're around us, you get neurotic. And my mother was neurotic. I just called my mother goofy. My mother had the neatest heart I've ever known and was one of the finest people I've ever known. But alcohol and alcoholism scarred my mother. They had an interesting way of treating alcoholics in Mayfield in the middle 30s. When my granddaddy got drunk, they put him in jail. When he sobered up, they put him in a chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. And my mother used to walk past her daddy at least once a week in good weather in a chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. The scarlet letter for my mother wasn't alcoholism or wasn't adultery. It was alcoholism. And it absolutely dominated the home I grew up in. My first recollection of conditional love was in my home. If I was a perfect little boy, my mother treated me well. If I wasn't perfect, my mother didn't speak to me. Now, let me tell you real quick, that didn't make me an alcoholic. But it sure as hell gave me the thinking that I've had to deal with in my recovery. If you read the big book in the 5th chapter and the 4th steps, as we go back through our lives, nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. And that was to look at and deal with those feelings and thinking. We say, it doesn't matter how you think, feel, and believe. You believe whatever you want to believe. How do we think? Each thinking precedes the drinking. So it does matter how you think. How do we feel? You think it doesn't matter? What are resentments? What is fear? They're feelings. And we deal with the feelings. Think, feel, and believe. Came to believe that a power greater. You know the story. So it really does matter. And my thinking started then and had to be dealt with. No, it didn't make me an alcoholic, but it absolutely laced my life with alcoholism. With alcoholism. Drinking wasn't a problem for me in high school. I became a perfect kid, partly to please mama, partly so God wouldn't burn my ass. But I became a perfect kid. And I was a good kid. Alcohol didn't bother me at that time. I didn't drink. Rarely, there'd be six or seven of us that'd go out and get a can of malt liquor about every 3 or 4 months. We'd drink that one can of malt liquor, then sit there and sing gospel songs. That's what you did in Mayfield in the early 50s. Sing gospel songs for about an hour or two, and then we'd go play Monopoly. And that was it. Went to college, and alcohol wasn't a problem. It was a problem for me. Alcohol affected me differently. I didn't see it so much in high school. It wasn't that much of a deal. But when I got to college, I was the first Brady who ever went to college. I didn't have a point of reference. And so I joined a fraternity. And that first semester of my freshman year, I would study 5 nights a week and make good grades. And then I'd go over to the fraternity house on Saturday night. I went to a college where the women's campus was on one side of town, men's campus on the other side of town. So on Saturday night, we'd go over to the fraternity house, get down in the basement, drank about 7 or 8 or 10 beers and just get lap-legged, and then go out there and get on top of that of a flatbed truck, and we'd go over to the women's campus and serenade the women. And we'd stand there just singing, and I'd just take off all my clothes and get naked, just singing up a storm, naked as a jaybird. Nobody else got naked, just me, you know, and I'd sit there and just be naked as hell. Now, I used to say for comic relief, nobody ever sent me flowers, there were no cards, all that kind of stuff. But I'll tell you who did notice, the dean noticed. Oh, yeah. Dean called me and he said, Burns, you're a nice kid and you make good grades, but when you drink, you don't act right. Why don't you quit drinking? And I thought, by God, he's right, I don't act right. So I quit drinking, no problem, that was it. So I graduated from college. And I started medical school at the University of Louisville in 1958. Now, this part of my story, I make no apologies for. But I will tell you that there's no one who appreciates and protects the traditions of AA more than I do. They couldn't. But this part of my story, there are places, not many in this country, that won't ask me to come and talk. And a couple of them have called me and said, we really want you to come, but you've got to leave this part of your story out. And as I looked at that part of the story and sat down and prayed with my sponsor, I asked God to help me know what to talk about. And in that story, the chapter of the family afterward, it says, our experience, in essence, is our greatest asset. For with it, we may be able to help somebody. So I tried to ask God what part of this wonderful story he wanted me to leave out. What part of this story, God, do you think really wasn't necessary? And I don't know the answer. But I know my story, and I know my journey. And I know that I can't discern God's will except to tell you what I choose to believe was what I had to grow up and learn to deal with. And this part of my story has to do with drugs. And it's a unique part of my story because I took drugs for 12 years with no alcohol. And I drank for 8 years with no drugs. Oh, I'm a card-carrying drunk. Quart of whiskey a night, 12-gauge shotgun in my mouth, drunk. And when I get through, you won't have any doubt that that's what I am. I have no doubt that's what I am. But this part of my story, which I cannot decide if God wants me to leave out, but apparently it helps people, and that's what it's for, had to do with drugs. I started taking amphetamine to study. I did not take amphetamine to get high. I'd never heard of the drug. Everybody in medical school took it to stay awake and study. I took it to stay awake and study. It hooked me immediately. It hooked me immediately. 2 weeks before graduation, my senior year, I got kicked out of medical school. In an amphetamine rage, I beat up one of my medicine professors. They took me to the head of the Department of Psychiatry, and Dr. Keller said, what's wrong with you, Burns? And I said, I take too many drugs. He said, do you believe that? And I said, yes, sir, I do. And he said, we can help you. I said, what are you going to do? He said, we're going to put you in intensive psychiatric therapy. And they did, for 2 years. I didn't take any drugs. Didn't drink. That wasn't a part of my story at that time. Psychiatry helped me. Psychiatry was the first place that ever told me that anger wasn't a primary feeling, that every time I got angry, look for resentments or look for fear. They taught me about feelings. They taught me a lot of crap that didn't amount to 2 miles of goat manure, but those things were really good. They taught me that I lusted after my mother, and I hated my brother, and I wanted a blue tricycle rather than a red tricycle. And I've come to know that a lot of that stuff was true. It didn't have a damn thing to do with my life, but a lot of it was true. But it was real good that they taught me how to identify a feeling, because when I got to y'all, y'all told me what to do with that, which was the 12-step process. But I went 2 years without any drugs, learned how to study without drugs, got back in great shape, was ready to go back to medical school, walked in prepared to take this thing on, and within 30 minutes I strung out on amphetamine again and just sat down and cried because I didn't know why. You know why? Psychiatry brought me knowledge. They brought me lots of knowledge. And they told me that was what they were going to do. They didn't tell me they were going to bring me a spiritual solution because that's not their job. Unless they want to do that. No, you know why that I couldn't stay off of it, because I had lots of knowledge. You, when I got to you, brought me a spiritual solution. AA has never run from knowledge. What we have said is we'll top it off with a spiritual solution, and that will be your salvation, and that will be your sobriety. That's what you taught me. That's the message. That's the message. That's part of it. My classmates enabled me that year. When I'd get too hot, they'd take me home, put me to bed. I was married, had one small child. Sally would call the medical school, tell them I had the flu. Hell, they knew better. Some of the ones who are still alive said, Burns, we knew what you were doing, but you were such a neat kid, and we figured one day you would grow up. Graduated in 1964. Between 64 and 67, I was in the mental hospital in Louisville 4 times. Strapped down, IV fluid, straitjackets. I might stay off amphetamine 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 hours, 6 months. Always went back and took it. Always put me in a hospital. The last part of it was really violent because we didn't know speed drugs had tolerance at that time. We know they do today. And it was really bad. Interrupted my internship, interrupted my residency. Finally got out of my residency in 1966. Went into practice for about 6 months. The Vietnam War was raging. I was strung out on amphetamine. Went into the doctor's lounge one day. And I was talking about the Vietnam War. And I got on a table almost and was raging at the Vietnam War. It's inequities. Inequities. Let us win or let us out. But this is crap. And I went through all that. And finally somebody said, well, if you don't like it, just join. I thought, well, hell, that's a good idea. So I went out and got in the car and drove to Frankfort and joined the Army. Didn't tell my wife, didn't call my office, didn't tell anybody. And see, that's the same way I am today. Without drinking. If it seems like a good idea to me at the time, hell, let's just do it. And if you think staying away from a drink for X number of years is going to take that out of you, if you're an alcoholic of my type, and that's the way you are, they call it impulsivity. I just call it crazy as hell. But I mean, that's just the way I do things. If it feels good, just do it. You know, if that seems right, let's just do it. Let's just do it. Got in the Army, and after a year, the post commander came down and said, are you taking the amphetamine? And I said, yes, sir. He said, well, if you don't quit, we're going to put you in Leavenworth. So I quit. Once he explained it to me, I quit, you know. Now, one of the great things that I have discovered that each of our experiences really is all of our stories are generally alike, but there is generally one little piece in there that seems like this is the message God wants, or this is the message that's at stake. One is amphetamine for 12 years, damn near kill me. No alcohol. Alcohol for 8 years, damn near kill me, with no drugs. That's the first thing. If you're in this program and you're ready to quit drinking and you think you can smoke a little dope, it may work for you. I've never seen it work for anybody else, but hell, it may work for you, you know? If you can think you can come in this program, quit drinking, and take a bunch of tranquilizers, it may work for you. I've never seen it work for anybody else either. It just doesn't work. And my story is real clear about that. There's another distinct part of my story. In my drugging years, and I've treated thousands of alcoholics, but I do, my job is to take care of sick doctors. I get them into treatment, get them home, rehabilitate them, monitor them, so I've treated hundreds of doctors. I also do the addiction work for a 250 men and women's homeless shelter. And I've treated thousands of street drunks and alcoholics. And with rare exception, with all the drug addicts, if we spell out the consequences, they can quit. If we don't teach them a way to live, they'll go back. With alcohol, there came a time when it didn't matter what the consequences were. It did not matter. I could not quit drinking. It was impossible. Came home from the Army in 1969. Got right back on the amphetamine, starting my practice, and within a year I had a gallbladder attack, which the doctors attributed to my amphetamine and a lot of the vasospasm. Took my gallbladder out. The internist, who's still my internist and a good friend of mine, and the surgeon, who was a good friend of mine, we sat in that Methodist hospital in Louisville, Kentucky, and we held hands and we prayed that I wouldn't take any more drugs. He said, you're a great doctor when you're not taking drugs. You are lousy when you are. And my last amphetamine was 1969. I never had a chance. Yeah. Appreciate it. No one's ever clapped at that. In fact, some people have booed and thrown me out. But the fact of the matter is, I never knew whether I was powerless over, never had to question whether I was powerless over amphetamine or not. And I know the prayers help, but I'll tell you what really helped is I started drinking. That much I'm sure of. I started drinking. And for 4 years, I didn't even drink alcoholically. I might get drunk, might stay sober. I didn't set out to get drunk. I didn't set out to stay sober. I didn't set out thinking when my first drink would be that day. Some days I didn't drink. Usually I did. Some days I drank a quart. But I never set out to get drunk and stay sober. Didn't impact my professional life. My marriage wasn't worth a damn from the day we first got married. I mean, she was crazy as hell and so was I. So who knows if it impacted my marriage or not. It was lousy to begin with. I mean, I'm dead serious. You know, the women we marry are not wrapped very tight when we get there, you know? And anybody who would marry me can't be wrapped very tight back then. And I'll get into that later on. But the fact is, it didn't impact my marriage anymore. It was impacted. And for 4 years, it was successful drinking. Then the next 3 years was addictive drinking. Every night, every morning, I got up and I knew when my first drink was going to be. It was going to be at 4:30. I had one of the most successful practices in Louisville, but at 4 o'clock, I walked out of that practice. If there were any emergencies there, my partner took them because I was out of there. I walked across to the 7-Eleven. I got me a quart of beer, stuck it between my legs, drove 25 miles home, drank that beer, walked in that house. This was the ritual. Got my scotch and water and sat there and got smooth. You remember smooth? Hell yes, you remember smooth. That's right here. That's about all we can remember is smooth. Yeah. I remember my first sponsor said, tell me the greatest time you had drinking. I said, oh, it's easy. 1973. I won a trip for three couples on a 75-foot sailboat in the Bahamas. And I said, we were down there. I was out on the front of that boat just like that kid in the Titanic. I'm up there just like this. And I could feel the spray across my face. It was wonderful. Well, he got me to acknowledge that wasn't spray. That was puke running across my face. But I got to tell you, when I was telling him, I thought, hell, it was worth it. You know what I mean? My God, it was worth it. It was a great, you know, the book is real clear. There'll come a day when we'll be unable to bring into our conscious memory with sufficient force the humiliation of a week or a month ago. We in medicine call that state-conditioned learning. What I've learned in this program is God's second greatest gift, the ability to forget. His greatest gift is this program so we can remember each part of it and resolve it. Take care of it. Clean up the wreckage of the past. Don't walk away from it. Confront it. And with God's help, we can deal with it. Right? Absolutely. But yeah, we will forget if you're an alcoholic of my type. This is the message the newcomer needs to hear. You're dealing with a disease which is 100% fatal. 100%. You want to live, you want to die. It's your call. But don't ever walk away saying you didn't hear what your choices are. What your choices are. The last year of my drinking, I drank addictively, and I drank a quart of whiskey a night. And told myself I wasn't an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. In 1975, my wife kicked me out of the house. I shamed her to the point that she had no choice. If she'd been sane, she'd kicked me out years before. But finally, even with her insanity, I shamed her to the point she had no choice. I've made my amends for that. She still hates my guts. She still does. But as I told, she hated my guts when we got married. But she hated my guts. But I've gone back and I truly can tell you that I respect and love that woman and I'm deeply sorry for the things I did. But I've worked my program and I've cleaned up that part of my life. Over the next year, I womanized and ran and just did some crazy things. Then I met Casey, who's now my wife and one of the neatest people in the whole world. Her daddy was a bipolar man, severe bipolar disease, and she grew up in a home watching her mother take care of her daddy. So Casey was a caretaker. And of course, I always wanted women to take care of me. That's exactly what I wanted to do. And Casey was a wonderful person. She took care of me, but was probably one of the neatest people I'd ever met. Certainly was one of the sanest women I'd ever met. Because I just got attracted to, well, it doesn't matter. She's just one of the sanest women I'd ever met. And we ran together and drank together for about a year and a half, moved in together within a week from the first date we had. And I began to realize how special she was. And I thought, if I don't quit drinking, I'll run her off like I've run everybody else off. And I tried to quit drinking. And I couldn't. I couldn't quit drinking. I tried everything I knew, like the book talks about. I even reached the point of delusional thinking, to the point that I would come home at night, sit down with my quart of alcohol, and I would drink it. And I thought, if I don't go to sleep, then I won't have to wake up. And if I don't wake up, the day won't start. If the day doesn't start, it won't be like this day, and I can't take any more of these days. That day, Casey had gone to work, and I was sitting in a chair, just sitting there, trying to get up enough of the energy and to stop shaking enough to go to work. And I was through. Those of you who are here and you're stuck here know that moment. I was through. It was over. It was absolutely over. I couldn't stand the line. I couldn't stand the weight. There was no dignity. There was no soul. And I couldn't take it anymore. And I couldn't quit. And I asked God to help me, and immediately I knew what to do. I mean, just like that, I knew what to do. The peace that came over me was the second greatest peace I've ever known. The greatest peace I've ever come to know in this program is I have a God of my understanding that loves me just as I am. Loves me just as I am. That was long in coming. And a lot of work had to go into that. And a lot of absolute need to come home. But I have a God who loves me just as I am. Loves me drunk, loves me sober, loves me in the wrong bed, loves me in the right bed, loves me cheating, stealing. I learned in this program that if I want to have any dignity, I have to not do those things. Because that's the way I need to treat you. Because if I don't treat you that way, I've got nothing. I've got nothing if I don't treat you that way. That's the only way to get peace, is to treat you with the dignity. But my God loves me just as I am. And that's the greatest peace I've ever known. The second greatest peace was that day when I said, God, please help me. And I knew immediately what I had to do. And I walked into the bedroom, loaded my 12-gauge shotgun and put it in my mouth, and I was out of here. Understand suicide. Suicide is abject hopelessness as a result of abject helplessness. I'd had 9 years of psychiatric therapy. I'd been deacon in 5 churches, and I could not quit drinking. Our great responsibility in this message is when that man or any of these newcomers or even the person sitting next to us reaches out that hand. You know where it came from? It came from Montreal at the International. When that hand is there, we take it. Because we are the first ray of light of help. And we bring hope. And we bring hope. At that moment of abject self-centeredness, abject self-absorption, because that's what suicide is. That's not a pejorative term. There was no higher power than me, and I had failed. At that moment of complete self-absorption, I thought, my patients will be better off without me. My mom and dad will be better off without me. Casey will be better off without me. And I got to my babies, and I choked. I'd had 10 years in private practice for that time, and I couldn't count the number of people who had come in to see me who were impaled on what did I do wrong when a significant person in my family, could be the mother, father, brother, sister, had killed themselves. What had I done wrong? What could I have done different? And I knew my babies wouldn't be any different, probably. What did I do wrong that Daddy blew the back of his head out? At that moment of complete self-absorption, I thought of another human being. And this is the message that I want every newcomer to hear real clearly, so you don't have to stumble around in it for 10 years like I did. My reason for being in AA just starts when I stop drinking. My reason being here is real clear. It's said throughout the book multiple places. The clearest place is in the 6th chapter and the 8th and 9th step. It says, our primary purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man. Our primary purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man. Our primary purpose is to fit, not to be, to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man. I've had therapists say to me, you're codependent. Hell yes, I'm codependent. Call it whatever you want to call it. But I have learned to survive, to be happy, to live, and feel that I am a part of this world. It's when I concentrate on, do I want to be in Sacramento or Roseville on Saturday night, 2,000 miles from Louisville, Kentucky? Hell no. I don't even like to fly. And I sure as hell ain't going to walk. But I'm here for one absolute reason, to stay sober, and that is to carry a message to one person out there in that room who needs to hear it. And if it ain't nobody else, then it's me. And I'm absolutely certain some of you need to hear it, and you are just absolutely clamoring for it. And this will be your night. And that's why I'm here. You don't have to agree with it. I'm real clear about it. I'm real clear about it. At that moment of complete self-absorption, I thought of another human being. I laid down the gun. Terror came back. I went to the phone, called a psychiatrist who graduated from medical school with me. And the first guy to my understanding was 5'9", wore glasses and stuttered, and was a psychiatrist. And I walked in to see David, and I said, David, please help me. And he said, you've got to go in the hospital. And I was looking at Our Lady of Peace, where I've been so many times. I said, that hospital doesn't help me, David, but I'll do anything you tell me to do. I became teachable. I quit negotiating. I quit manipulating. Now, all those skills were going to return at about 2 years in this program. But at that particular time, they left. And I went to treatment. I went to treatment in New York for about 3 weeks, and then went to Atlanta for about 3 months, and then came home. Came home to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came into AA in Louisville, Kentucky, in the spring of 1978, I came into AA in what I call the best of times for AA in Louisville and the worst of times. It was the best of times because the fellowship was indescribably wonderful. There were about six or seven of us who became hooked at the hip. I mean, we went to the bathroom together. We went to meetings together. We went to 7 days a week. We didn't just live this program 30 minutes early and 30 minutes late. We lived it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We would call each other in the middle of the night. Our wives just totally immersed themselves in it. And it was incredibly beautiful and warm and fuzzy. I still think of those as wonderful, warm and fuzzy years. You remember? It was the worst of times in AA in Louisville, Kentucky, because we never mentioned the big book. It wasn't even mentioned except there's a big book. Read it if you get a chance. The mantra for AA at that time in Louisville was don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, tell him what's wrong with you. He'll tell you what to do. Do it, and then go save a drunk. They left out that house cleaning middle, didn't they? And for 10 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I lived 3 1/3 step. The first 3 and a third of the 12th step. And I was sicker than a dog. I mean, I became a lethal weapon for God. That's exactly what I was. Yeah. I mean, they'd say, here he comes, drink a beer because he's going to take your ass to treatment anyway. That's the way it was. And you talking about opinionated, I had an opinion about everything from red lights to root rot. And I told you in a heartbeat and expected you to follow it. And that was it. And that whole group of us stayed sick. Now, we were one small section of Louisville, and in retrospect, God was kind. He kept the rest of the people away from us. Even I began to notice that there were people who would come to our meetings that we got into treatment, stay for a little while, and get the hell out. And they seemed to be pretty happy. I thought they were probably had some sort of mental illness, but I mean, they were happy, not around us. And we seemed to be fighting with each other all the time. It was an incredibly weird period of time. I loved my friends. I loved the things we did together, but I wasn't a happy man inside. I controlled every move. I would control your bowels if you'd give me 15 minutes to do it, and I sure as hell was going to control mine. I mean, that was the way it was. Now, about 10 years in this program, and for some of you who are sensitive, and I've prayed and thought a lot about this, but the story is so powerful that I don't know any way to leave it out. And I've cleaned it up with my wife, and she understands this, and she's at peace with it. But at 10 years in this program, I had an affair. And the things I learned from that and the things I share from that have been monumental in my life and in many other people's lives, because I think the record for AA is to be married at least 12 times in 10 years, or you're really not trying, you know? And throw in a couple of affairs and illicit stuff at the same time, and then you probably are able to stay at least in the middle of the pack. But let me tell you what was behind that deal, because it's a very powerful story. Let me take you back to my home of origin. I learned real early in my life, without even knowing it, that when I was perfect for my mama, who was the supreme woman in my life, my mama patted my butt, parted my hair, picked up my dirty clothes, and she raised a monster. She raised what Thibault called King Baby. And my very feeling about women became solidified as a woman is supposed to take care of me and make me feel special. And so every woman that I brought into my life, that's exactly what their role was. I didn't know this, but the ones who didn't do that were out the door. And the ones who did do that were crazy. So I went through women after women after women after women. That's the way it was. Now, Casey and I had a perfect marriage when we quit drinking. She quit drinking when I did. She went into Al-Anon for 6 years. And we had a perfect marriage for that 6 years. I know it was perfect. Let me tell you about it. I wanted my wife to have the finest clothes at least I could afford. And I saw that she got them. I had them delivered. I never asked her what she wanted. I wanted her to have nice cars, and I had them delivered once a year. Never asked her what she wanted. I wanted her to have wonderful vacations, and we went on wonderful vacations. I chose the place, took her on them, and never asked her where she wanted to go. I wanted us to pray together, and we prayed together. I know, because I prayed every morning, and she listened. I wanted us to have wonderful sex together, and we must have had, because I did everything I wanted to do. I mean, this was a perfect marriage. You know? Why are you laughing? At 6 years, Casey heard her story. So you newcomers, if you haven't heard your story and you need to be here, keep coming. Because Casey heard her story at 6 years, came into AA, and in 7 years, 8 years, she came to me and she said, Burns, I've never loved you more. I just adore you, but I want to go back to college. I want to start going to my own AA meetings, and I want to go into therapy. What I heard was, you're leaving me. What do we do, at least to male alcoholics, because I don't work with women alcoholics. That's a line for various reasons, not just sex. It has to do with a whole bunch of studies we've done about role modeling, and it's real clear. So I just work with males, and I don't know about women, but I got to tell you, what do men do when our caretakers don't take care of us? We go find another one. It may be righteous as we're doing it, but we go find another one. Now, what do nurses do for doctors? At least when I was a doctor back then, nurses were the old vintage, and they took care of doctors and made them feel special. The new nurses say that's bullshit, but the old nurses used to take care of us and made us feel special. And that's exactly what they did. And I had a nurse that worked with us. At this time, there were seven of us, and we each had a nurse, and I had a wonderful nurse. She'd been divorced for 2 years. Neat lady. I mean, this was a neat lady. She still is a neat lady. But Kathy began to achieve almost virgin married types of proportion to me, and so I fell in love with her. The physical part of that relationship was very short-lived, and it really wasn't a major part of the deal. The emotional thing was very intense and was a lot longer. And I'd fallen in love with two women because I still loved Casey. And I had two women in my life I adored. Now, I'm 52 years old at that time, and I've been sober 10 years, and I'm sitting praying for God to show me how I can convince both of these women that all three of us can live happily together. And I'm watching some of the heads, and the guys go, yeah, I understand. A couple others, wonder if he pulled it off. How'd you do it? Yeah. Well, I went to my sponsor and told him the deal. And he said, shouldn't do that. I said, I agree, I'll get out of it. And on the way, I went home. By the time I got home, he'd called my wife and told her. You wonder why Wilson wrote, we believe in principles over personalities? Let me tell you what I found. This program is a perfect program composed of an awful lot of imperfect people. That's right. And any of us who take on the responsibility of being sponsors need to be sure we tell our people we sponsor, don't expect me to walk on water because I don't know where the stumps are. But I'll give you what I've got for today. That man in my life gave me for 10 years. He was one of God's great angels. I cannot begin to list the things he gave me, and I know why he was in my life. I do the work at the men's homeless shelter, and I rotate chapters 5, 6, 7. What we do in the men's women's homeless shelter is we put them through non-medical detox, and then we bring them over, give them a big book, and for 6 months we teach them the big book using Joe McQuaney's Recovery Dynamics, which teaches the book as a textbook. And so when I rotate chapters 5, 6, and 7 and go in there and twice a week and go through this with them, I'll get to the point where we're going to deal in the 5th chapter and the 4th step about resentments, and I will tell them this story. Now, I'm talking about these guys, most of whom can eat that wall. I've done 50, 200 fifth steps, but I've held guys in my lap and rubbed the back of their head that were twice my size as they sobbed and cried, and some male had told them, I love you, and it's okay. Most of these guys have been in prison, and they are big, rough men. And they're sitting there in this room. There's about 100 of them sitting there in this room. And I tell them this story, and I say, now, what should I have done? And they'll sit there for just a minute and look at me and say, you should have shot the son of a bitch. And I say, yeah, that's a normal reaction, but let's take a look at the book. Every piece of my story is told for an absolute reason. It's humorous, but there's a reason. And I take them to that book, and we go through it. If you haven't been there, please go, because this is the total fulcrum of where the change in thinking occurs in the alcoholic. Not from what did they do to me, but what can I do for them? If you can't make that switch, you may not drink, but you can't get this program. You can't get this program. And it doesn't just stop there. That's where the first realization is, this is a sick person, how can I help him take away my anger? Thy will be done. It took me 3 weeks to read the next paragraph, which said, we can't help everybody, but God can help us be tolerant. I don't know how many of those men have followed that journey with me of learning, not what did they do to me, but what can I do for them? I finished the rest of that. The reason I'd gotten into that was because never leave before the miracle. A little pigeon of mine with 7 months sobriety came to me after he had done this, Jim had done this, and handed me these tapes and said, listen to these tapes, Burns, and see if they're any good, because I love them. And they were Joe and Charlie's tapes, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. As I listened to those tapes, I began to cry because I saw for the first time that there really was a 12-step program. It was the first time, and there was a book. There was a textbook, a guide to being able to learn the principles of this program. And I became completely dedicated to it. The last 12 years of my life has been a 12-step program. And I got to tell you from my experience, if you want to live with fewer than 12 steps, you can do it. If you're really dedicated to not drinking, you can not drink. But if you really want to be happy, if my story means anything, it's a 12-step life with a wonderful guidebook. And if you have in your own heart a resentment against Big Book Thumpers, then you've already got a start on that wonderful opportunity. You know, a wonderful start on a great opportunity. Because I hope to God that there is never a day where we don't have Big Book Thumpers. I hope to God that for those of us who are Big Book Thumpers, we never get to the point where we can't be tolerant of you people who just don't want to do that. But what I do want you to do is be real careful about the message you carry the newcomer if that's not your way of life in this program. You are entitled, and I protect your right. I absolutely agree with your right to believe anything you want to believe, but please don't try to put that ignorance on some newcomer, because then it gets deadly. Then you're dealing with lives other than your own, and you don't have that right. You don't have that right. No, you don't. Not ever. No, you don't. I had 11 copies of those tapes made, and 12 of us began the first Big Book study in Louisville, Kentucky. And that was in 1987. There are now at least 50 to 60 Big Book studies. I'm not talking about mental masturbation studies. I'm talking about ones where you get in there and really do that stuff. Get in it in blood, sweat, and tears. And I've seen so many lives change. If you ever read Bill Wilson's last talk, you know, all of our clubs have Dr. Bob's last talk. Very few of them have Bill's last talk. And Bill was too sick to give that talk. But read it sometimes. It's about 5 or 6 paragraphs. And Bill made 2 points. One was that anonymity, he came to know, was ever more essential to sobriety. The other was, he said, AA must and will change. And I looked at that in about 1989. I thought, man, that's heavy duty stuff. What does that mean? And I called Geraldine D. from New Jersey. And I'm sure, did you ever know Geraldine? She died with about 55 years of sobriety, and about 2 or 3 years ago. But she ran a treatment program there. One of the neatest ladies I've ever known. And I called Ms. D. and I said to her, has AA changed since you came in? She said, yeah. I said, how's it changed? She said, when I came in, said there were probably, at least 2 or 3 old-timers, dedicated members of this program. She said, at least 2 or 3 old-timers for every one of us newcomers. She said, today there may be 40 or 50 newcomers for every old-timer. She said, we've got people with 1 year, 6 months, year and a half sponsoring people. And I said, is that bad? And she said, that's not necessarily bad. She said, what I think is going to be real treacherous for us is if we've got people sponsoring people and they don't have a sponsor, or they haven't done their own Big Book and 12-step work. And as I've come to look at that, what I've come to believe is no sponsor should ever sponsor if they haven't done their own step work. No sponsor should ever sponsor if they don't have a sponsor. And certainly nobody should ever sponsor if they don't go to meetings. Now, for those of you who think that's an opinion, it certainly is, but it's an opinion based on burying a hell of a lot of people. And I finally decided some time ago, I was really tired of burying people that didn't at least get a chance to hear the structure and the tenets and the principles of this program. Those of you who haven't done your work and want to sponsor somebody, let me suggest to you, you just drive the car for a while. Take them to a meeting, let them find a sponsor. While you are too. When I got into this book, I was fascinated by the fact that I found rather quickly when it said that my problem wasn't alcohol. And I thought, wait a minute, when you get as many tickets as I get, put in jail as much as I get put in jail, what do you mean your problem isn't alcohol? No, it said my problem was my thinking. Y'all remember reading that? My problem is my thinking. Wilson even called it a peculiar mental twist. And he said it's so important that it precedes each drink. It's a peculiar mental twist. The peculiarity is that I could ever believe that I could drink like a normal person. But that doesn't start where tonight one of you will walk out and say, I think I'll have a drink tonight. No, the relapse doesn't start tonight. We used to tell our newcomers, so-and-so drank on Saturday night, but his relapse started 6 or 8 months ago. And that's the peculiar mental twist, the rationalization, the justification, the delusion of how did I get from point A to point Z. And I want to share with you the peculiar mental twist in my mind, because Wilson never goes any further than to say it's a peculiar mental twist. But I want to tell you how it affects what it is in my life. And please listen to this, and I hope it means something to you. First part of the peculiar mental twist in my life is bigger than the rules. Bigger than the rules. You know, AA does have rules. Read Silkworth. He said, if these men follow a few simple rules. Remember how somebody came in, by God, I'm glad you got suggestions. If you'd have had rules, my ass would have been out of here last week, you know. When I came in, I was praying that you had rules. And you could teach them to me. I've got 9 points on my driver's license. That means if I get 3 more points in Kentucky, I walk. And I was sitting at home last year saying, why do I have 9 points on my driver's license? I said, well, you idiot, you go 95 miles an hour in 65 mile an hour speed zones, they give you tickets. I said, well, I know that, Burns, but why do you do that? Well, I must be stupid. No, you got all kinds of degrees that says you're not stupid. Well, then I must be crazy. I don't know, you got all kinds of discharge summaries that says you're not crazy. Well, if I'm not crazy and I'm not stupid, why do I go 95 miles an hour in 65 mile an hour speed zone? And I thought, I know, it's because I'm Burns Brady. You can't do it, but you're not Burns Brady. I can do it. Handicap parking zones. I know you shouldn't park in a handicap parking zone, but I'm only going to be there 5 minutes. Yeah, and now I've gotten so spiritual that I will come up to a handicap parking zone and I will sit there and there'll be a space about 3 spaces down. And I could park right there, but no, I sit in that and I go, God, don't let me park in this handicap parking zone. Please, God, don't let me park in this handicap parking zone. And I'll circle the block, pass right by that place. Come on, God, don't let me park in this handicap parking zone. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is stupid. Hell, yes, I know it is. But God, don't let me park in this handicap. And I've heard people from the podium say, we think like normal people. Hell, we don't get close to thinking like normal people. 25 years I practice medicine. You cut a normal person, they'll bleed. You cut one of us, we'll bleed. We lose a loved one, we cry and grieve. They lose a loved one, they cry and grieve. They're sitting at a red light and it turns green and somebody honks, they just kind of go and they drive off. We're sitting at a red light and somebody honks, we get out and slap hell out of them. Or we wonder for at least a month, why was I such a wuss or a weenie that I didn't get out and slap hell out of them, you know? And I got to tell you, we don't think like normal people. And I got to tell you, Wilson knew this. We're playing 2 sandwiches short of a picnic in our brain chemistry the day we're born. And I'm telling you, this is the truth. We're not playing with a full deck. And this is brain chemistry. You couple that with old tapes, and you got a lethal, lethal situation. Absolutely. And we're not even coming close to play. Hell, for the first year after we get sober, medical science tells us now, short-term memory, simple problem solving, stress management, all those are shot all to hell. It's because of our brain chemistry. I lost my car drinking all the time. I lost my car for 1.5 years sober, repeatedly. And if you can find your way into this hall, I can promise you, you haven't burned up your brain. Just stay around and you'll find your car in a parking lot. Please believe me because it's very important. Bigger than the rules. Bigger than the rules. I was laying in bed one Saturday morning about a year ago. And my wife was going to an Al-Anon meeting, and she said, you haven't been acting right for about 2 days. And I said, no, nothing suits me. Blah, 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 blah. And she said, it's been longer than that. She said, I need to tell you. She said, I know I'm going to an Al-Anon meeting, but I don't have time to screw around with this. I'm going to tell you what your problem is. I said, what's my problem? She said, you've gotten bigger than this program. And I said, and I thought, wait a minute. All you got to do is hook your belt to my belt, and you're going to ride a spiritual rocket. How in the hell can you say that I'm bigger than this program? And she sat there and she said, Burns, you haven't called your sponsor in 6 months. I sat there and I thought, she's right. Real subtle, isn't it? See, I know this morning when I got up, I knelt beside the bed at that motel. And I did my 11-step prayer, my 3rd-step prayer, my 7th-step prayer. Today, it's been a real easy day. I've lived by the 10-step, very few challenges. And tonight, when I go home, you can pretty well bet, at least for tonight, with this kind of energy, that I will do my 11-step closure. If I do that every day, and especially those days where I sit quietly and for 10 or 15 minutes, I let the power of this power greater than me come into my body and my head and my heart. And if I do those things, it doesn't matter what happens. Life is better. Do I do them every day that way? Do I? And if you tell me you do, you're lying like a dog. Bigger than the rules. And what did Wilson call that? He called that self-centeredness. What did the psychiatrist call that? Narcissism. You know what my standing diagnosis at mental hospital is? Psychopathological, narcissistic, sociopathic personality disorder. That means I have the psychiatric profile of a serial killer. And they were right. They diagnosed what they saw. My disease is alcoholism. My behavior is psychopathic. If I don't drink and do these steps, it doesn't have to be that way. If I don't drink and don't do these steps, it gets right back there. Bigger than rules. Second part of the peculiar mental twist, victimization. You're my problem. You haven't been sitting in that chair right, and if you'd sit in that chair right, then I could have given a better talk tonight. You're my problem. Victimization. Oh yeah, I was born very poor. I milked that till I like to die. If you'd been poor as me and had the caddy rather than Bronco Country Club, you'd been a drunk too. If you had to work your way through college, you'd been a drunk too. If you had to work your way through medical school, you'd been drunk. If you'd had to marry that rich bitch and stay married to her for 17 years, you'd have been a drunk too. I talked at an Al-Anon conference in Tulsa. Now, there's a distinct difference between an Al-Anon conference and an AA conference. And the distinct difference is all the people in the Al-Anon conference all sat in their chairs. And in AA, what you look like, it looks kind of like a beehive. Everybody just crawling all over each other, just like this. Now, it took me a while. I mean, I first thought that was disrespectful until I realized most of those people are withdrawing. You know what I mean? There's a difference between the two meetings. And the Al-Anons, you know, their butts so tight, they sit in those chairs a lot better than everybody else. And hell, we never get ours tight enough to hold on to a chair. So, I mean, it's a great arrangement. You know. But I talked this Al-Anon conference. I was a token AA speaker, and on Saturday morning, I was supposed to talk at 9 o'clock, and I got down there, and I met four or five AAs, and we went down, and it was a neat little cafeteria. It was a little different. The waitress came over, gave us our plate, gave us our orange juice, set our silverware down, and then we took the plate, went through, and got food. So they asked me to go first, and I got my food, and I came over and sat back down at this table. Orange juice was gone. The napkin was gone. The silverware was gone. I thought, why would she do that? And I got up to go tell her in my best spiritual fashion to please bring me what I needed. Took two steps and realized I sit down at the wrong table. But my first instinct is, you're trying to screw me. I mean, I don't know where it came from. I just know it's there. And what did Wilson call that? He called that resentment and self-pity. Another synonymous word for self-pity is victimization. Victims may not drink, they just don't get sober. They just don't get so. You live in a victim state. I live in a victim state. And if I stay there, I will guarantee you it's a miserable life. It's a miserable life. Third part of the peculiar mental twist is square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome. If a square peg doesn't fit in a round hole, just beat hell out of it till it fits. It reminded me when I was drinking, I put my kids' toys together. It may start out being a wagon, but by the time I finished, it flew and they got it and that was it. You know? And that's it. Square peg, round hole, bigger hammer. And what's the reason of us trying to do that? What's the reason I do that? Because it's the second half of the first step. It is the seminal issue of relapse. There will be a number of alcoholics in this room that will drink, and it may be me. Not a one of us will drink because we don't believe the first half of the first step. We will drink because we can't deal with the second half of the first step. The seminal question every morning is, who is in charge of my life? Is it me? Or is it God? And there are mornings I will sit there and I'll say, wait a minute, God. And I'm not talking about 20 years ago. I'll sit there and I'll say, I don't know. God, that's probably not your will. I mean, I really think that you're in charge, but I'm not sure about this particular issue, God. I don't know that I should put you in charge of this because this is a tough issue, God. And I'm not sure I won't ever quite say I don't trust you, but I think maybe you're counting sparrows and you ain't here with me right now. Maybe you're out there doing some shit somewhere over across the river. I don't know where you are. But I'm not sure remember we used to come and say, God won't give us more than we can handle? We've heard that. I believe that. But let me tell you, I screwed that one up. About a year in this program, I came in and sat down next to my sponsor. He said, 30 minutes early, 30 minutes late. I walked in there at 1 minute late, sitting in that chair. He looked at me and said, I want to talk to you after the meeting. I said, okay. And we got out in his car. And he said, where in the hell were you? And I said, oh, God thinks I can do more than I can do. Why do you say that? And I said, oh, I had to get up this morning at 4 o'clock and deliver a baby. I had to go in there and circumcise the kid, and then I had to see the mother, and then I had to go see all the hospital, and I had to go to a staff meeting, and then I had to go to a nursing home this morning. Tonight I had to go back for a staff meeting. I had to go back and check the mother. And I went through a whole litany of things. And then he said, "Next week, Burns, bring me your appointment book." I said, "Why?" He said, "I've just never seen God's handwriting, and I don't want to miss it." Oh, yeah. Fear and control. Fear and control. That's the square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome. What have we looked at? Bigger than the rules. Self-centered. Victimization, resentment, and self-pity. Square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome. Fear and control. And we've got a whole chapter that starts to tell us how to deal with those in this 12-step solution. Yeah. It's called a spiritual solution. And the only answer that I've found for my alcoholism is a spiritual solution. One of the things that I've become increasingly aware of is how many people in AA want to make a spiritual solution smoke, mirrors, and magic. What I have found is it's a wonderful mystery. And the mystery is, I may not be there to see the circle close, but it always closes. But I'm privileged to be a part of that circle in some place. Bill Wilson said this program is spiritual, and spirituality is divided into two components, humility and responsibility. I've watched more people in this program get impaled on the third step than I can count. They sit in a corner and pray and turn everything over to God, and I can almost feel God's voice saying, "I love you. Thank you for turning your life and your will over to me. Now, please get off your butt and do your work. Please get off your butt and do your work." I have watched people get impaled on 449 in the big book till I almost want to cry. I've listened and say, you set somebody in a meeting and they say, they raped my wife, they stole my kids, they burned my house, they burned my crops. You just have to accept. Give me a break. Well, of course we have to accept. But how many times do people tell you to quit drinking? You already knew it, didn't you? What we want to say is, please tell me how. And we tell these people to accept, but we don't tell them how. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. What is acceptance? Acceptance, serenity, love, peace. All of those are beautiful byproducts of a 12-step process. They don't just hang out there in space. And we can't will them anymore. We could will quitting drinking. And those of you who know that book know there's a line in there that says that we couldn't will away our resentments any more than we could will away our drinking. It's a process of hard work and belief that it will work and hanging on to the sponsor. I'm going to give you a spiritual diagram to take with you. I give it to my guys in the healing place. It's a triangle on its point on a base. See the base? And the triangle is on its point. It's perfectly balanced. You want a balanced life in this program? It's perfectly balanced. On this corner of that triangle, sponsor. On this corner of that triangle, meetings. On this point of the triangle, the big book. Setting on a base of honesty and today. And if your life's screwed up, look at that diagram and see which part you're not doing. You think that's an original diagram with me? I just put it on paper. It's called the 11th step closing inventory, and it's also called the 10th step inventory for the day. Outlined beautifully. But those of us who are short-memoried and need a picture, take that picture with you. And if you're screwed up, have you talked to your sponsor? Are you making your meetings? Are you doing your steps? Are you being honest? Nobody can make it in this program if they can't be honest. And are you staying in the day? Real quick. Perfect. About 3 years ago, I began to study Bill Wilson's life. I became intrigued by Bill Wilson. Not because of his perfection, but because of his imperfection. The more I studied Bill Wilson, the more I became absolutely deeply in love with God. And knew more than ever that I was exactly where He wanted me to be. Because I found out from studying Bill Wilson's life, in the AA Army, the wounded soldiers can serve. The wounded soldiers can serve. This is a program for those of us who will never be perfect. It is not a program to try to get perfect. And it's absolutely essential that I hold that up for me and that I give you your imperfection. If you ever get a chance, read Wilson's life. If you reached a point of your own tolerance, forgiveness, and love to be able to not be hurt by the imperfection of our patron saints. I never believed more than today about the spirituality of imperfection. I'll close by talking to you about my family. My children say I'm the single greatest person in their life drinking, and I was the single greatest person in their life sober. I was the role model that changed their lives, even as teenagers. And I'm grateful for that. My mama died in 1978, died of cancer. I had 8 months of sobriety, and I got to go down and live those 8 months with her and make my amends. And my mama died with a lot of dignity, and we loved each other more than ever. Those of us who have gray hair and bald heads know more than ever how really grateful we are for our parents, don't we? And how much we miss them. How much we miss them. And if we worked our program, even if they weren't perfect, we were able to forgive and to love. My daddy married almost immediately after that because my daddy's like me. He's male-oriented and female-dominated. And that's exactly the way it is. I can't imagine not having a woman in my life. I know somebody says, well, if you worked your program, you may be right. I don't know. I haven't had to face that. But my daddy died, my daddy married a mutual friend of his and mother's, a neat lady. Peggy was a great gift of God. I went down to try to make my amends to daddy, and daddy was so steeped in his shame about my alcoholism, he thought he'd caused it. And I learned this from Peggy because he used to cry after he was beginning to lose his mind about, and my brother's an alcoholic, and he used to cry about what he'd done wrong that me and my brother were alcoholic. And he was so steeped in that shame that my daddy couldn't tell me it was okay. And I've never worked with a single male that didn't want some significant male to tell him it was okay. And daddy couldn't do that. My sponsor pulled me off of him and said, quit trying to shove those amends up his butt. He can't take them, so walk away. Just be content that you were willing. Daddy then began to lose his mind, like Alzheimer's, but it really wasn't. It was hardening of the arteries. Peggy and I put him in a nursing home, and I used to drive down to see Daddy. This was between my sobriety years, between 13, 14, 15, 16. Really a turbulent but beautiful time. I had to clean up all that mess with the affair and with my wife. Casey and I went into therapy along with working our programs, and I cannot tell you that our marriage wasn't scarred from that. It was. It's a different marriage. I won't say it's better, won't say it's worse, but it's a different marriage. But it had to be cleaned up, and we did. But during that period of time, and I cleaned it up with Kathy, and the whole thing, y'all know we've been there, you just do those things. That's the only way to do it. But this thing was happening inside me, which I call spirituality, the ability to think of other people. And I'd drive down to see my daddy and 250-mile drive home, and I'd say, God, take away my pain, because I just wanted daddy to recognize me, because he didn't know me, he didn't know my mother, he didn't know my brother, he didn't know anybody anymore. And I'd go in there and I'd work with daddy for all day and then get back in the car and drive home, never work. This one particular Sunday, I drove up and parked the car, and for some reason, it was coming into my soul. I said, dear God, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be. And I walked in, and he was sitting in a wheelchair. He thought I was my Uncle Buster. And I walked into daddy, and I said, Hal, can I help you? And he said, yeah, Buster, would you shave me? And I shaved my daddy. And I said, would you like to go outside on the porch? He said, I believe it would, Buster. And I rode him out there. Peggy came in. She and I were sitting there talking, just talking. Daddy used to love to watch Mother and me talk. And we were talking, and daddy was looking at us. Around said, would you like to go out in the yard? And he said, I believe I would. And I rolled him out there. Peggy and I got to talking again. Daddy was looking at us. Raised up in the chair, his wheelchair, and he said, son, today you're just like the little boy your mother and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me. 10 seconds later, he didn't know me. He never did again. We buried him in 1992. Now, the miracle of recovery is not that my daddy recognized me, because I can explain that. The miracle of recovery is the change that occurs in the heart of an individual who changes from take care of me to what can I do to take care of you. This part of the story I'm going to tell you I've only told twice before, because I've only come aware of it in the past 6 months. The last time we put Daddy in a hospital, he just wouldn't die. he was just like this. He didn't know anybody. His eyes would just stare straight ahead, and he'd had heart failure and multiple end organ problems. He'd just sit like that. Didn't hear a word. So I drove down, and Daddy was just rigidly sitting on the side of the bed, and I walked in. It's on a Sunday afternoon. It's in the hospital. And Peggy was there, and I, how's he doing? Same. And I said, go out, Peggy, go outside. Let me talk to Daddy. Well, she went, I don't know why I did this. But I pulled my chair up because I knew my daddy. My daddy was a good man. I pulled my chair over to the foot of the bed and looked at Daddy and I said, Daddy, I don't know if you hear me, but I need to tell you something. I can't imagine that there ever being a better daddy in the world than you. I can't imagine that there ever being a better husband than you to my mama.